Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I love the story of how Kat fell into this particular work, because I guess her day job is a professor at North Carolina State University, where she teaches scientific journalism and or science journalism and creative writing. But after her day job and the evening comes or other times come, she finds herself out there looking for things with her dogs and enjoying that that part of it that so many people love. So without further ado, I want you to please help me in welcoming Kat Warren.
Thank you, Derek, and thank you for having me. And I'm going to do about three things tonight. I'm going to open, give you a little bit of context. I'm going to do some reading, obviously, for the podcast. I'm going to show a video of solo training and then open it up to questions. This is a little bit of a bait and switch. This is Solo, my German Shepherd, when he was 4 weeks old. And, yeah, he's cute, isn't he? A little son of a bitch. He came to us when he was 9 weeks old, and the first night that he was with us, my arms were black and blue with puncture marks by the end of the evening. He had tried to hump the female Irish setter whom we had adopted from my father. She was standing there drooling in distress, and I was in bed with my husband crying, saying, "I don't like him." And he said, "We'll just return him." And of course, that made me cry harder. And, you know, he knew that, and he knew that that would, you know, spur me to trying something. And part of the problem with Solo was that he was a singleton pup. And there hasn't been a ton of great research on this, but there's been enough by people like Patricia McConnell, who has experienced this because she takes on dog behavior problem cases. And singletons don't get that puppy experience in the litter where they're trading thousands of signals with each other constantly, where they're biting and whining and biting back and, you know, easing up on the bite and, you know, pissing a little bit because they're feeling really put upon, and so the dominant dog backs up a little. Singletons don't get that. They tend to be dog aggressive, and they can also even be human aggressive because they really are this. He was called His Royal Highness by the breeder. And Joan tried very hard, actually, to find a litter that was the same age as Solo to put him with the litter to give him that. But she could not find a litter the same age. So so he came to us, and I wanted something quiet and obedient, and I got a dog that was neither. So I'm going to pick the story up on Chapter 2. And this book is about 20% memoir at the most, and about 80% a kind of reporting project and history project. And I got interested in the science of everything. So the book switches back and forth between those modes. And this chapter two, is called Death and the Dog. And I will just read. I usually have a little frontispiece on each chapter. Although they have been cherished for their good qualities, hunter, guard, herder, friend, worker, the inverse dog is the spoiler of human graves, an eater of corpses, the keeper of Hell's Gate. Paul Shepherd, How Animals Made Us Human. 2 months after Solo's arrival, I found myself in Nancy Hook's backyard in Zebulon, perched on the edge of an aluminum folding chair. Nancy slumped back in her sturdy canvas chair, her hand wrapped around a foam beer insulator, wrapped around a Gatorade. She was mellow except for the warning she occasionally gave the dogs quarreling in the kennels next to the yard. don't make me come over there. They stopped. It was mid-July and too hot to fight, in any case. Japanese beetles clattered past. Tent caterpillars had wrapped up and skeletonized half the leaves of the huge pecan tree we sat under. I knew Nancy from when I'd taken Zev, who was my prior sweet, gentle German shepherd, to her parking lot obedience class some years before. She had been welcoming and kind to both of us, although not particularly interested in Zev. He had been so mild-mannered that he tended to disappear in a dog crowd. I hadn't seen Nancy much since, but I started to remember as I pulled into the drive and read the black bumper sticker on her pickup. Gut Deer? Modeled after the Got Milk campaign. Her hair was still copper, her chestnut eyes still surrounded by smile wrinkles. She wore camouflage pants. I had emailed Nancy in desperation. Solo had flunked out of 4 puppy obedience classes. I had changed vets 3 times. Well, a couple vets just looked at him and said, "That's going to become a really mean German shepherd." And I thought, you know what? This is not a good relationship to start with a vet. Let's find somebody who likes even impossible little SOBs like Solo, and let's see where we can go with that. So Nancy said, "Sure, come on out to Camp Hook. Bring the dog." She was competent and relaxed. I was edgy and talkative. Solo, more obnoxious than any 4-month-old German shepherd should be, was hackled and humpbacked, wild-eyed and ungainly. From time to time, he surged toward the kennels, a dark hybrid of colt and Tasmanian devil. He would snarl and bounce off the cyclone fence. I bounced off the lawn chair, wrestling Bill Jack dog treats out of my fanny pack, trying to distract him and minimize the behavior Nancy was witnessing. "Solo, Solo, watch me. Good dog." I funneled liver into his mouth. "Stop chattering at him," Nancy said, "and stop giving him so many treats. You're making him into a wuss." My hand froze in mid-dive. "He's just a jackass," she said. "What do you want to do with him?" And with that simple question, my weird dog world started writing itself. By "what do you want to do with him," Nancy didn't mean endless rounds of dog counseling and dog tranks, creating a sedated and submissive shepherd who needed an occasional cautionary dog whisperer, hissed, with an index finger raised to keep him in line. Nor did she mean, you may tell that I'm not necessarily a huge fan of all of Cesar Millan's methods. Nor did she mean that I could click and treat this dog into executing perfect obedience routines. That didn't work with him. Besides, I was bored with the obedience ring. Nor did she mean that Solo was capable of becoming the quintessential park dog who would allow me to sit on a bench with other tranquil owners, gossiping, watching our dogs romp and bark into the sunset. She meant, what would you like this dog to do? I had no idea. I wanted him to be so busy he didn't have time to do what he was doing in front of Nancy. I wanted him to have a job, if possible. Not a pretend job that would simply exercise out his little heart of darkness. Probably not a job as a therapy dog in a nursing home, because of his rhino ways. I wanted his work to have meaning, as I was constantly struggling to find meaning in my own work. Nancy didn't indulge my angst for long. "Stop thinking so much," she said. "That's part of your problem." She ordered me to leave Solo alone. I pulled my hands away from the greasy treat bag and put them at my sides. I turned my gaze away from Solo's evilness. Within a couple of minutes, he came over and flopped in the shade. Being bad wasn't as interesting if I weren't reacting. Nancy and I talked, running down my options. She taught everything from housebreaking to bite-breaking to obedience and trailing. Training Solo for search and rescue wasn't ideal. I couldn't leave students waiting in the classroom for a lecture on feminist essentialism because I was running off to search for a lost 3-year-old who was in fact playing with Transformers at the next-door neighbor's house. Nor could I count on my own body being the ultimate fitness machine, capable of running for miles after a dog tracking in thick underbrush. I might end up asthmatic, shambling, sciatic nerves aflame, eyeglasses either fogged or smashed. Lost people needed better odds than I offered. let me offer North Carolina woods as opposed to Colorado. I was a newspaper reporter in Wyoming, and I still remember being able to look out, but you don't do that in North Carolina. That made sense to Nancy. Besides, she had become less enamored of search and rescue team politics over the years. She described them in ways that made them sound similar to my English department without the Victorian charm. More issues emerged. I didn't want to wear search gear that would make me look like a Girl Scout. Then there was the idea of a team. I could collaborate, but I couldn't really relate to the cheery phrase, "Remember, there is no I in team." It didn't suit Solo either. Better that he didn't constantly have to deal with the hurly-burly of dog society. Sending him out to track alongside several self-assured search dogs, they wouldn't put up with his nastiness. They'd reduce him to tufts of red and black fur spread over the trail. There was one way around all of the scheduling problems, my team player problems, and Solo's psycho puppy problems. Nancy was pleased with herself for coming up with it. A cadaver dog. I didn't know exactly what Nancy meant, but I could guess. Dead dog. I'm good at putting words together and knowing what they mean. It's what I do for a living. It's ideal, she told me. The dead will wait. In the meantime, they emit scent. With a few frozen exceptions, more and more scent over time. And cadaver dogs and their handlers work mostly by themselves in methodical search grids, not alongside other dogs and handlers. The dog's job is both simple and complex. Go to where the scent is strongest and tell the handler it's there. It's work that needs to be done. Families and law enforcement, mostly, although not always, want bodies found. Besides, she told me, beaming, her smile lines in full evidence, it's a ton of fun. You'll love it. Nancy avoided mentioning that my salmon-colored linen pants were probably not the ideal thing to wear on searches. At the end of our session, she sent me and Solo off down the road. I was sweaty, I reeked of liver treats, and I was filled with inexplicable happiness about those who go missing for a long time. Solo, exhausted, slept soundly in the back seat, although his outsized feet continued to twitch, pedaling air conditioning instead of a cyclone fence. Nancy, knowing my compulsive habits, expressly forbade me to read about training dogs on cadaver scent. I would screw up Solo's training by reading too many theories too soon. She had two exceptions, Bill Cyrotuck's Scent and the Scenting Dog and Andy Rebman's Cadaver Dog Handbook. I ordered the two books. Then, because waiting isn't my forte, I sneaked onto the web to learn the basics of death and dogs. Here's the front quote for the next section. No house would stand firmly founded for me on the Uruhu-created earth were not there my herd dog or house dog, Ahura Mazda, Zoroastrian god. In 2012, archaeologists in the Czech Republic published their discovery of three skulls of what appeared to be domesticated dogs, shorter of snout and broader of brain case than their wolf cousins. One of the skulls, 31,500 years old, had a flat bone fragment, probably that of a mammoth, inserted in its jaws. It was so purposeful and evocative that the archaeologists couldn't help speculating. Was that bone part of a funerary rite, appeasing the spirit of the animal, inviting it to come back, or encouraging it to accompany deceased people? The speculation wasn't much of a stretch. For all that dogs seem to lurk on the edge of civilization, we've also let them in and granted them special status. For thousands of years, and in numerous religions, the living have depended on canines to help guide the dead, to get us from here to there, wherever there is. Few myths have such worldwide resonance. One can see the temptation of assigning dogs this task. They appear custom designed for it. Dogs howl at the moon, warning us that death is just over the horizon. They can hear and smell, growl and hackle, warning us of specters that our dull senses miss. They also like to eat things, even us, given the opportunity. Dead people aren't so different from other dead animals. We're protein. Given an opportunity, dead people get smelly. We become deeply attractive not only to bottle flies, but to more developed animals, like dogs. Part of the religious connection of death and dogs no doubt comes from a ritualized spin on the grim but useful reality that dogs and other canids, like jackals, scavenge. People witnessed that behavior, done with joy and impunity, and came to the obvious conclusion that dogs and their close relatives must be powerful, immune to the demons of death surrounding bodies. That made canids useful beyond the simple housekeeping functions of getting rid of bodies. So, in ancient Egypt, in a simultaneously pragmatic and religious switch, the jackal dog became a god, Anubis, friend of the dead, protector, not predator, of the deceased in their tombs. While artwork and accounts of Anubis are plentiful, we have only one or two 19th century accounts of how the ancient Bactrians in what is now Afghanistan handled this canid propensity. Those accounts note that the Bactrians used dogs called Canis Supercalis. The dogs had a specific job description: to eat the dead. In exchange, they received the greatest care and attention. Quote, "For it was deemed proper that the souls of the deceased shall have strong and lusty frames to dwell in." It was a pretty nice deal for the deceased, who got to hang out in a mobile furry coffin. The limited history doesn't note what happened after the dog died. In Persia, the Zoroastrians made canids' roles more layered and central to mortuary rites. Like the Egyptians and Bactrians, they clearly decided to make the best of canids' tendency to love smelly protein. Zoroastrians were already using working dogs as a central part of their ancestors' nomadic herding existence. Mary Boyce, considered the greatest scholar of ancient Iran, wrote that, quote, "Mortal dogs receive a striking degree of attention," unquote, in Zoroastrian holy texts. They likened the dog to fire, both protective and destructive. Quote, "It seems probable that this power came to be attributed to the dog because dogs are the animals always referred to in the Avista, the holy text of the Zoroastrians, as devouring corpses," Boyce wrote. It takes some real mojo for dogs to do that and not be harmed by Nazu, the demon that brings putrefaction. The funerary rite in Zoroastrianism was called Sagdid, seen by the dog. It took a special kind of dog for this work, a kind of German shepherd-like dog. The ideal Sagdid dog was to be at least 4 months old and male. They were a little sexist. Brownish-golden, with four eyes, perhaps not unlike Rustin Black Solo, with twitchy black spots of fur over his eyes. One of the cast metal art objects in the Tehran Museum looks like a stocky German shepherd, although German shepherds didn't exist then. The dog could be white, too, with tawny ears, probably not unlike what we see in the Canaan dog of Israel, an ancient herding breed still in existence, or one of the guard breeds of that era. The dogs chosen for Sogdid got paid for their work. Zoroastrians knew their dog training. Three pieces of bread were placed on the corpse to induce the dog to approach, gaze steadily on the body, you can see the dog looking at the bread, and drive Nasu away. This would be exactly how I started training Solo to both recognize and happily approach the scent of human death. Only I used liver treats and then toys rather than bread to draw him in. The work of dogs didn't end with Sogdid. After the four-eyed dog was done with his job, corpse bearers took the body away, and the village dogs and vultures followed and feasted. Zoroastrian dogs, from the herders to the hunters to the house dogs and the village dogs, had a pretty good deal. They got especially well-fed when people died, and not just by getting a bit of bread or helping dispose of bodies. They were given a whole egg and portions of the food offerings for the dead. When Zoroastrian house dogs died, they got extra special treatment. Mary Boyce noted, "Until the mid-20th century, when a house dog died, its body was wrapped in an old sacred shirt tied with a sacred girdle and was carried to a barren place, and brief rituals were solemnized for its spirit. All the rituals sounded lovely, especially the one for the house dog. It was a step up from what we did with Zev, who died at the age of 7, my German shepherd, after he died. We got his ashes in a hard plastic canister from the vet. The canister came with a burgundy velvet sack with a little rainbow bridge embroidered on it. The canister still sits in my great-grandfather's oak secretary drawer. I don't know what we're waiting for. We should probably carry his ashes to a barren place. So what happened was that I trained with Nancy for about a year, and then I was invited by the Durham canine police sergeant to train solo with them because they didn't have a cadaver dog. They had patrol dogs and narcotics dogs and bomb dogs, and he was very generous. And I learned a great deal from him, and I'm actually still training with him to this day. I see him about once a week still. And Solo became a cadaver dog. And what that meant was that occasionally over the course of his working life, I would get a call from law enforcement saying, we've got somebody we'd like you to look for. And I would go out with Solo. And so the final little portion I'm going to read to you is the beginning of a chapter called Into the Swamp, which comes about halfway through the book. And I want to read it for a couple of reasons. I'm actually missing Solo. He just turned 11 a few days ago, and he's not here. And it also gives a kind of continuity to understanding how dogs work scent, and I'll also be able then to show you the short little video of him training. So he's about 3 years old here, maybe 3 and a half. Patrol cars were parked helter-skelter, radios popping, laptop screens glowing through darkened windows. A few cops, scattered across the apartment project's dismal lawn, looked up as my Camry slid in. I lowered the rear window so Solo could be ID'd, and he provided his profile, sticking his bear-sized head and chest out the window. One officer hitched his gun belt and jerked his head. 10-4 on the canis searches. It was a fine afternoon for a search. The morning wind had calmed, and the late spring air was heavy with unseasonable heat. If scent were out there, the swamp would capture it. It would be hanging like invisible moths on the vegetation, floating above pools of water, waiting for the dog's nose to harvest it. This was not the first search Solo I had been on, where some central characters were drug dealers. I suspected some were watching us from concrete stoops as I got out of the car and sorted through my minimal equipment in the trunk. The cops were talking to the missing person's girlfriend. I heard sobbing. I leaned further into the trunk to pull out my backpack, willing myself not to look. It wasn't my business. This was our first search where climate change probably played an indirect role. It wouldn't be the last. Drought followed by a tempest of rain had caused flash floods. Sheets of water slid off dry, hardened soil into overwhelmed storm drains. Water, silt, and trash cascaded into the already polluted remnants of Triassic Basin wetlands and woodlands. We have a lot of swamps where I live. The suspect's flight reportedly started with a 911 call. The caller told police that a group of men were selling drugs out of a car. Police arrived. They realized one of the men was wanted for a parole violation. When they went to arrest him, the suspect broke away and fled into the woods. Flooding and darkness made the search dangerous. After a patrol dog tried to track him and nearly drowned, the cops pulled out. By then, the suspect was long gone, into the woods and swamp beyond. He called his girlfriend from the middle of the swamp that night. That was the last time she heard from him, she told police. His cell phone had gone dead. The girlfriend and his family waited a couple of days before calling police to say he'd never made it back home. At the police station an hour before, investigators and I stared at a satellite map of the area. It was acres. Some of it would be muddy. Some might be flooded. I tried for calm confidence, though my heart bounced around in my chest. There in the station, I helped make decisions about how to run the search, trying to sound as though I'd done it 100 times before, even while I confessed my novice status to the participants standing around a table. I tried to lower their expectations, and mine. I'd been training with Mike Baker, the canine sergeant, for nearly 2 years and with Nancy Hook for more than three. It felt like nothing. I slowed down my voice so I didn't sound like an eager amateur. "I'm just a volunteer," I said. "Dogs aren't perfect," I said. "They're just one tool among many." I said all those things, and I believed all those things. But when cops call in a volunteer, they want results. I knew that as well. A couple dozen cops were on standby, expecting to make a line sweep of the swamp, and left solo when I could find him. Even though I'm a Yankee, North Carolina woods aren't alien to me. So when the police asked what I needed, I asked for two people to accompany Solo and me, if they were available. Even within urban limits, a few acres of floodplain can contain sinkholes and creeks with eroded sandy banks that may crumble beneath you. And, you know, the irony is that these sandy banks are actually is construction silt, right? It's not even sandy natural to the Triassic Basin. This is runoff that has just gone down into these wet areas. Two people could get us out if we got stuck. Those were just the natural hazards. I didn't want to be out there alone meeting the kind of guy we were searching for. Let me note, just for the record here, that this was a sincerely not nice guy. There were more than parole violations there. The two investigators who cheerfully volunteered to accompany us arrived at the scene at the same time I did. They were clad for strolling down a linoleum hallway, not slogging through a swamp. The one wearing natty tasseled loafers and creased tailor pants was getting grief from his colleague, who was also wearing office clothes that were only slightly more suitable. The sharp dresser joked about water moccasins and copperheads, but he wasn't laughing that hard. A couple of the bloodhound handlers from the Triad Foothills, whom I'd trained with for a couple of years, had told me that only people with phobias ever see venomous snakes. I'm not phobic, and I knew that wasn't true. I wore no loafers with tassels. I had hastily changed out of my cute linen office outfit, and I looked like an aging outward bounder. Nancy would have been proud of me. I was shod in hiking boots and cross-country skiing gaiters to discourage ticks carrying rickettsia or Lyme disease. They might even deflect a reptile fang. No hat. I didn't want to look like a complete doofus. A fine-tooth flea comb would do the trick post-search to flick ticks out of my short hair. As usual, Solo provided extra sound effects, mewling, crooning, sounding more like a great Serengeti cat than a German shepherd. Any of you who knows shepherds, they tend to be actually fairly, most of them fairly expressive. They're whiny. Even his whiskers twitched. He had on his sturdy nylon harness that could double as a handle to suck him out of the swamp if needed. He hated the harness, since it signaled a bit of constraint in what he thought should be an unconstrained life. It meant he might have to work on a long line. Tough titty, it was staying on. I ran a final mental checklist. Water, water bag, bug spray, tug toys to reward the dog. I hadn't forgotten those as I dashed out of the house. They were as essential as water. We had graduated from one hard rubber Kong to two rope tug toys. One could be thrown straight into his jaws and the other held in escrow. Solo was still a jackass, too possessive of the tug toy, especially after a difficult training. Using two solved the problem. I always had the fun tug in my hand, the one that could get flung because it wasn't stuck in a stubborn German shepherd's jaws. We no longer had a power struggle at the moment when he and I should both be feeling fine about the work he'd done. With the permission of the commanding officer, I'd also planted a mason jar with redolent training dirt a good distance away from the search area. To explain, one of the nice things that we use for training is that if somebody's laid out in the woods for a while and had a chance how do I say this nicely, to melt a bit. After a scene is processed, we usually go out with some mason jars and a little trowel, which I usually throw away afterwards, and harvest that dirt because it has all the compounds of human decomposition. But it's also sort of brilliantly innocuous, right? It's a jar of dirt and could never be mistaken if you're going out searching for an entire body of, say, hi, I found a jar of dirt. So I plant the dirt away from the scene, and it's because that it's never a given that we're going to find something on the search. 9 out of 10 times on a search, you actually don't find somebody. You're clearing areas. But critical to Solo's day ending in a satisfactory way was letting him find some bit of the dead. Mike Baker had given me a gentle lecture after one of Solo's first long searches. We hadn't found anything, and I hadn't brought any training material so that I could give him an honest reward. Solo needed to be paid for his work, just like I did, Mike noted. This time I remembered Solo's paycheck. My list checking was simple distraction, a rosary of search equipment that slipped easily through my mind. Solo's distractions were more concrete. Dog piss on the rusted jungle gym, and dog piss on the grass, making his tail curl defensively. As we walked toward the woods, children from the apartments, having stood back at first to watch from a distance, now surged around us, chatting like magpies, then leaping back and screaming in exaggerated fear as Solo swung his huge head in their direction and wrinkled his brow. They weren't dogs. They were just little people. He relaxed his tail to wag slow and low, all stiffness gone. Around children, he dialed back both his drive and his rhetoric. Don't worry, he's sweet, I told them. He wasn't always sweet with me, but he was with others. He's big, huh? He won't hurt you. He loves kids. He wasn't a therapy dog, though, so we kept moving the whole time. Before we entered the fickle shade of the mimosa and the elderberries and trees of heaven that have colonized and overwhelmed the edges of those Piedmont woods, Solo paused to inhale a last resentful snort of dog piss baked onto a corroded steel post. Then the two investigators, the dog, and I ducked under the yellow crime tape and through a jagged hole in the chain-link fence. We straightened up on the other side, and I took one of the rope tug toys out of the training bag and tucked it ostentatiously into my pocket. Solo yowled and spun in delirium, kneecapping me with his big shoulder. I winced and unhooked him from my aching arm. I was tempted to clock him, but I reminded myself that once again, searches were not the time for etiquette lessons. I didn't want him to sit or heel or watch me with adoration. I wanted him to find the body. Unhooked, and far more obedient off-lead than on, Solo stood frozen, waiting, his eyes fixed outward, then sliced back to my pocket, then down the hill littered with empty liquor bottles, toddler diapers, a shattered big wheel, a rusted washing machine. He didn't need to hear the command, but the words focused and centered me, reminding me that we'd researched this dance for a couple of years. The least I could do was get it started. Solo, go find your fish. That's what we called it. He did a final brief tarantella around me, striking the pocket where I'd stashed the toy with his open muzzle. Not a bite. It hurt nonetheless. Brat. Then he barked sharply and disappeared into the dense undergrowth. I'm going to stop there. I'm happy to take questions at this point, and I've been asked to repeat the question, so I hope that I don't sound like a parrot.
Did you temperament test your second search dog before you obtained
her? Did you temperament test your dog, the second dog, before you got her? And the answer is that the breeder did, because the breeder is a working dog trainer and handler from West Virginia who's had, she's really brilliant. And Coda, this pup, was the pup that tested out with the highest hunt drives and the greatest stubbornness. And So, yes, one the interesting thing, and I will just add a little more to this because it's really important, that law enforcement canines and most military canines, you don't even look at the dogs until they're 14 to 18 months old, because very often you can't tell what a puppy is going to become, and a lot of dogs wash out, and so, you know, law enforcement, I mean, a lot of the cops laughed when I said, yeah, I'm getting a puppy, and it's sort of like, come on, cat, get a juvenile, cat, right? No, a puppy, right? This is what we volunteers do, and I don't regret it, and I'm learning a great deal from her, and I will learn more. So, other questions? Yes.
What does Solo do now that he's not working?
Solo is not a complicated dog. No, I mean, look at him. He's a happy, as long as I have a toy, as long as you're challenging me mentally. I still occasionally train him. I've still done demos with him, right? Because he loves to show off in front of other people, because he actually knows that I won't correct him as severely as I might if there weren't witnesses, right? Of like, just give the damn toy, right? You know, but if I have high school students standing there, Solo knows that he can actually parade around and doing victory laps a longer time. Plus, I sometimes train him with Coda because he actually helps increase her drive. By him going first, she watches him, and the excitement that he brings to it, which is consistent and sort of unyielding. Coda, who is a little more sort of like, look at the fly, will immediately go, well, wait a second, what's he doing, right? And it gets her head into the game. And so he's a good demo dog, both for people and for Coda. Yes.
How often did you find bodies?
How often did I find bodies? Not that often. And I'm happy to say that Solo and I got called out maybe 6 or 7 times a year, which isn't terribly frequent. On the other hand, I wasn't associated with a team. I was just training with law enforcement, and it was only very much word of mouth. I've actually now joined a small team, and I expect that will probably mean more call-outs. But as Andy Rebman, who wrote the Cadaver Dog Handbook and is throughout this book because he's a brilliant trainer and handler who's now in his late 70s and works all over the world, really very often when you're going out, you're ruling out areas, right? If somebody is missing, if a family thinks, for instance, that their father has committed suicide and they have 15 acres behind the house, you're not going to cover that absolutely thoroughly because that's an area that needs searching, right? And so did Solo have some recoveries in his career? Yes. And I'm proud of that. But it's really interesting that once you work with people, it doesn't – this is going to sound like I'm not being self-aggrandizing, and it's really honest. It doesn't matter who finds the body, right? As long as it's found. My nightmare, and every handler's nightmare who's honest about it, is that you miss somebody who's there, right? That somehow, because of your search technique or how the dog was that day, or because you didn't notice the injury on his left hock, and it kept him from going over the deadfall when the body was on the other side, right? And then somebody finds that person. That's when you feel bad. A day-long search where I find nobody, but I think that we've done a righteous job searching, to me is as rewarding as, in its own way, as finding somebody, if that makes sense. Yes.
Human body have a different odor than, say, a decomposing deer or some other?
So the question is, does the decomposing human body have a different odor than, say, a decomposing deer? And the answer is yes. It's understand that there's a lot of crossover. One of my thought experiments is always to wonder if we could get hold of some well-preserved Neanderthal, for instance, what the dogs would think of it. But I'm very serious that we, of course, train the dogs to ignore animal remains because, for instance, on highway searches, right, and these happen not infrequently, where somebody's dumped somebody off the edge of a road, there's also 200,000 deer and dog corpses in the ditches along that road too. So it's enormously important. And when you're in the woods, you're constantly coming across bone scatter. And if you didn't have a dog that could immediately check those bones out and say, not human, right, you'd have a problem. That said, we know some of the things, but not all of them, that may make humans unique and more interesting to dogs, cadaver dogs, than, say, animal remains. But there's not a great good answer on that. It is fascinating. What we do know, and what's kind of cool, is that science hasn't caught up with it. On the other hand, you train the dogs carefully and proof them off animal remains, and you don't have a problem, right? And certainly there are cases, and this is very important, where killers have been known not unfrequently to bury a body and then put a dog on top or another animal so that when investigators come along, they dig down, they find the dog, they say, up, right, and don't go down further. So there's all sorts of, these are the permutations that fascinate me. They sound grim, but when you're out there, you very much realize that, first of all, the person is already dead. The tragedy has already happened. The real tragedy is actually that the person remained missing, because people really do need resolution. You know, law enforcement need it, family need it, friends need it. And so you're so busy when you're out there actually making sure the dog has a good time. And when you're doing the training, you're always trying to figure up mashups that will either confuse you or confuse the dog or confuse the trainer, so that the dog and handler become better and better with those different mix-ups. That was a very long answer. Yes, in the back.
With dogs' hyperacute olfactory senses, what have you heard of them detecting, say, prostate cancer from the urine sense or along that line?
Yeah, so the question is, and it's a good one, what do we know about dogs detecting cancer, essentially, with their acute olfactory senses? What we know is that there are some studies out there. Some of the studies were, in my opinion, flawed, because there were other explanations for the dog's alerts, such as the people who had cancer were also getting chemo, and it's possible that the dog was alerting not on the cancer, but the chemo, right? There are some interesting new things coming out. I think there was one on thyroid cancer with one dog. That's a one-dog study, which to me... not a big control group. The answer is, can dogs do it? Yes, I think they can. The second thing is it useful and scalable? And I think that one of my worst nightmares is to think of all these dogs in lab coats sitting in a little factory with slides being passed under their noses. I say that a little bit joking. I think that it's actually fairly useful that there are dogs that keep pushing their noses against the small of somebody's back, and the person finally gets it checked out and discovers that indeed, yes, there's a tumor there, right? I think that if you have a scent, you can really isolate it, that dogs are enormously good, if well trained, at detecting that. And I think that we're seeing that with well-trained conservation dogs, for instance, on endangered and invasive species. And I think that this has been going on for some time, right, between drugs and everything else. But we're coming up with all these new things that dogs can do. One of my concerns is that there's a lot of crap out there. And that was probably the wrong word to use, but it is the correct term. And what happens is that the media kind of get hold of these stories, and it gets exaggerated, and gullible people, and it makes me very sad, right? Diabetes alert dogs. Can you train dogs to do diabetes alert? You bet. Are there people out there that are taking terrible advantage of vulnerable people and charging $40,000 for a diabetes alert dog that's not? That's also equally true. So end of sounding outraged. We'll go back to cute dogs.
In the event of a larger disaster and search and rescue dogs are working, can the cadaver dogs go in at the same time, or is that
This is such an interesting question, and it has all sorts of implications. So the question is, in the instance of a disaster, can the cadaver dogs go in at the same time as the live find dogs? And or is it confusing? The short answer, it's not confusing for the cadaver dogs. It is confusing in a search area where you have a possibility of finding live people that has to be the first priority, right? And in a case where you're doing those kinds of searches, you want to take the live find dogs in first. I know that there are some very good cross-trained dogs. I know lots of law enforcement people that have very good trailing tracking dogs that are cross-trained cadaver dogs. It can be difficult in disasters when dogs are being asked to do both at once. So, you know, the dead well wait. We don't want them to wait too long, but certainly in the case of a disaster, I think it's already horrible enough, right, getting dogs in there, keeping them safe. I think you want to send the live find dogs in first. Everybody knows what I mean by live find.
How long does it take for the, how would you put it, the aroma of death?
So the question is, how long does it take for the aroma of death, the perfume of death, to arise from a corpse? Immediately. Think about blowflies. They absolutely know it instantly. And there was a really elegant little study done in Germany on this, and I write about it in the book, where because of a actual criminal case where the prosecutor wanted to know whether the husband had thrown the wife overboard after he killed her on the mattress on the yacht, which is what the dogs said he did, the forensic anthropologist took two people who had donated their bodies to science, who had literally dropped dead on the street. Both men were less than hours dead. He wrapped each of them in a sheet. There were no punctures. There was no DNA, no blood, no liquid. And he laid them for 2 and 10 minutes each on top of carpet squares. So basically you had a sheeted, freshly dead person exposed 2 minutes to a carpet. The three dogs in this study, two of them were nearly 100% accurate because they were a little older and more experienced. The third was a little younger, they were all Belgian Malinois, and she was about 85% to 90% accurate, which is really very good. So the answer is within moments. I've experimented a little bit with fairly fresh blood with the dogs. That's not their primary function. You can have blood in lots of situations. You know, 5 minutes and the dogs say, oh, that's decomposing blood. So this really is, the book is actually more cheerful than what you're hearing here. And it's not just about cadaver dogs. It's also about tracking and trailing dogs and law enforcement work and kind of what we know about the science of scent. So shall I take one more question and then we'll wrap it up? Yes?
Will you be signing and selling books?
The question is, will I be signing and selling books? Are you a plant? Why, yes, you are. Yes, I will. And as a matter of fact, I brought Solo's nose print. He was really miffed when I painted charcoal on his nose and kept taking a piece of paper and smashing it against his nose and then going, no, you moved. Hold still. And so I would love to stamp people's books for them and sign. And the book is available pretty much everywhere. But I do like independent bookstores. And thank you so much for being such a good audience.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.